Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the Millennium Development Goals top the agenda at the United Nations this week. Hear from Honduran Cardinal Oscar Rodriguez, who'll be attending the special session in New York. Looking for a miracle in Lourdes. Despite the difficulties between the two churches, the Anglican leader and the Vatican's top spokesman on ecumenism come together in prayer at the Marian Shrine in France. And making a joyful noise unto the Lord. That's exactly what a group of professional musicians and singers have been doing in some of Rome's most famous churches this week. Following Pope Benedict's pilgrimage to the Marian Shrine of Lourdes earlier this month, another top Vatican official has been visiting the shrine in southwestern France this week. The head of the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity, Cardinal Walter Kasper, joined a rather special pilgrimage made up mostly of Anglicans on Wednesday, marking the feast day of their own Marian Shrine, Our Lady of Walsingham, on the North Norfolk coast in eastern England. Led by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, the group of Anglican bishops with over 400 pilgrims attended a Mass in the Basilica of Lourdes, celebrated by Cardinal Kasper, and then attended an ecumenical seminar on the theme of the Church's mission for unity. Before the Cardinal left for Lourdes, I asked him about the significance of this event for the Anglican-Catholic dialogue.
Yes, Lourdes is known for its miracles, and this is also a kind of a miracle that people from Great Britain and Catholics and Anglicans are coming from the National Marian Shrine of Walsingham to Lourdes in a common pilgrimage, and the theme of the pilgrimage is unity of the Church, and I think that's a significant sign of our times and of the situation of the Church, that Anglicans with, I do not know exactly, 8 Anglican bishops are coming and headed by the primate of the Church of England, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who will do the homily whilst I will say Mass. And I think it's an important sign, and it signifies that our ecumenical pilgrimage made many progress, many steps ahead. And not only also Mary, issue of controversy in the past now, is no longer so much dividing, but uniting and reconciling the churches. So I'm very happy to go to Lourdes, and I look forward, and I think it's a significant event.
This is, in fact, the first time that an Archbishop of Canterbury, I believe, has ever been to the Shrine of Lourdes, which is seen as such a significant centre of Catholic devotion. What do you hope, perhaps, will be the consequences of this?
Well, we had the last document of our commission, ecumenical commission between the Anglican Church and the Roman Catholic Church, is about Mary. It's a very nice document, Mary, Grace and Hope, and a very positive document. And it's not a full agreement, but a very high degree of agreement I never expected before. And so there are many things under the way already now, and I think this could be also seen as a consequence of it, because the Archbishop is very much in favor of such theological dialogues. I started in the last days a little bit about the English Reformation, which is not so well known for Europeans, and I found, well, the King Henry VIII, he destroyed this Marian Shrine of Walsingham, but the English reformers, as I maintained, the dogmas of the ancient church and also what is in the apostolic creed, the believing in Mary as Mother of God and ever virgin was clear for them, and also traditional Marian feasts during the liturgical year were maintained in the Church of England. And so there is an old tradition, but since the Enlightenment all was a little bit neglected and forgotten. But I still today think more the so-called high Anglicans or Anglo-Catholics are very much in favor of Marian devotion, and there's not a big difference between us and them, and I hope that Mary can help us in our ecumenical pilgrimage.
And yet, during your recent visit to the Lambeth Conference, you reiterated that the Church of England decision to push ahead with the ordination of women bishops means that it's no longer possible to see what you called a clear path to unity. How do you place, if you like, this miracle of Lourdes, as you're calling it, within this clearly very difficult road ahead on the Anglican-Catholic dialogue?
I think, first of all, such a pilgrimage is a spiritual event, and spirituality is the heart and the core of the ecumenism. It's not only documents, it's not only manifestations, that's prayer. And in this, under this aspect, such a pilgrimage is very important. It can help our dialogue. It can help also the Anglican communion to find together again and to overcome all these rifts of the last months and years. And so under this point of view, I see it very, very positive and constructive. Well, I think that not the liberal Anglicans will come to Lourdes and not the two evangelicals, but there are different tendencies in Anglicanism. And well, we must, as Catholics, we must take the Anglicans as they are. And if they come to Lourdes, they are welcome and we are happy about it. And we will share our common faith and also our common devotion on Mary. And this will bring us ahead. This is not a thing you can calculate. That's a spiritual event.
The Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, is leading this pilgrimage. What is your message, very simply, to him on this occasion?
First of all, I'm very happy to meet him again. We are more or less friends, and I am happy to meet him in Lourdes, and I hope he will sustain in this way also our dialogue and our further going on in the ecumenical dialogue. It's true, after all these decisions of the Church of England and the Anglican Communion, the dialogue is much more difficult, and well, the decision for women's ordination to episcopacy is a hard point for us, but nevertheless, we will go on in the dialogue under different auspices and so on, but I think already will help us, and ladies know always a way out where men are helpless, and so Our Lady will help us too.
I've known about Lourdes since I was about 10, I suppose. To read about it, so it's been somewhere I've longed to visit for many, many years.
In his homily at the Mass in Lourdes, Archbishop Rowan Williams spoke movingly of the miracle of faith that is often communicated in a mysterious way when words and actions fail, when we feel most lost and confused. As he was preparing to head back to the UK, I asked the Anglican leader what he hoped could be achieved by an ecumenical pilgrimage of this kind.
I think in the short term, it's simply an opportunity for praying together and growing an understanding, but also, I think, for the sort of conversation that we were able to have yesterday afternoon when Cardinal Casper and I opened up a dialogue on Mary and the unity of the Church. In the longer term, who knows? We all know, I think, that we're at a quite difficult point in relations between the two churches worldwide at the level of negotiation and official dialogue. And yet, on an occasion like this, we discover how very much we do have to talk about. That's not insignificant. We discover, I suppose, that we are, in many important respects, speaking the same language.
At one level, as you say, though, the dialogue has never seemed perhaps so difficult. Cardinal Casper is talking about shifting our focus for the goals of dialogue, since full visible unity seems to be off the agenda in the current situation. What do you understand by his words that he said to you at the Lambeth Conference recently?
I think in a way there were no surprises in what Cardinal Casper said. It's what he said privately and publicly, that the ordination of women as bishops, other issues in the Anglican communion mean that the integration and recognition of ministries between the churches is not something about which we can hold our breath in the immediate future. And yet, and again this came out very clearly yesterday, the notion that the long-term goal still has to be some sort of tangible and visible unity, that is something we can still hold on to, even if we don't imagine that we're going to negotiate it into being in the next couple of years.
You say you'd always longed to go there to the Grotto of Lourdes. Can you tell me something of your impressions, your reactions when you first went to pray there at the Grotto and in the Basilica?
I found it almost indescribably moving yesterday to be with this vast, vast crowd of people drawn together to celebrate the Incarnation, to celebrate the healing will of God, and to think, and I suppose this is the most remarkable thing of all, to think of a barely literate teenager in the 19th century being like the pivot on which all this turns. It's such a powerful illustration of the Magnificat itself, God exalting the humble. And I think that's perhaps the most utterly striking thing about Lourdes. It begins with this girl from a desperately poor background, not very well instructed, suddenly becoming the place where, the pivot on which things turn, the place where things change. And that I found, yes, something that moved me deeply.
You talked in your homily, indeed, about being open to the voice of God in these most unexpected places, as the young Bernadette herself was. And yet it's quite a difficult message for the institutional churches, both Anglican and Catholic, to grasp, isn't it?
It is, and it was difficult in Bernadette's time. I remember from my very early reading about Bernadette, the reaction of the parish clergy to her, Abbé Peramal, the parish priest at Lourdes, and his deep reluctance to accept that this girl had anything to teach him. So it's, I suppose, something that runs right through the Christian story, whether we're looking at St. Anthony of Egypt, St. Francis of Assisi, or Bernadette, you know, the people on the edges bringing renewal in towards the centre, so to speak.
Lourdes is one of the most important shrines, seen as a place of very Catholic devotion. There will be, I'm sure, those within your own Anglican communion, within the Church of England, who see this as perhaps a step too far. What is your message to them?
I think my message is that everything that I've seen here is actually focused on Jesus Christ. That the prayer, the devotion goes on here, deeply Christocentric. And yesterday, sharing in the procession of the Blessed Sacrament, I think one can't, again, easily forget the impression of 15 or 20,000 people in silence gazing at the host and thinking, well, whatever's at the heart of this, it is the gospel and the Christ of the gospel.
My thanks there to Dr. Rowan Williams, Archbishop of Canterbury and leader of the Worldwide Anglican Communion. And earlier you heard Cardinal Walter Casper, head of the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity. Government leaders, business representatives, human rights groups and development organisations gather at the United Nations in New York on Thursday to discuss progress on the Millennium Development Goals aimed at cutting global poverty, sickness and illiteracy by 2015. Approved by leaders of nearly 200 countries at the UN back at the turn of the millennium, these ambitious goals were designed to lift people in the poorest nations out of poverty through a mixture of debt relief, relief, increased and more effective aid, fairer trade regulations and a crackdown on corruption in developing countries. In a message marking the opening of the UN General Assembly, Pope Benedict asked God for guidance and strength to help world leaders carry out what he called the urgent tasks facing the United Nations in the coming months, including the continuing implementation of the Millennium Development Goals. Among those attending the special UN session is the president of the Caritas Internationalis Global Development Confederation, Cardinal Oscar Rodriguez Maradiaga. He told my colleague Charles Collins about the significance of these Millennium Development Goals and the vital need for both rich and poor countries to keep those targets on track.
Every time that the United Nations is defining some goal for the future, the world becomes more optimistic. And of course, in our faith, we are full of hope. But then, many times we realize that these are only words. When there is no political word or political will to put them in practice. I believe this is the theme of Millennium Goals regarding the reduction of poverty to the half by the year 2015. The amount of resources destined for development is not enough, and this is one of the obstacles. At the local, at the actual speed, I don't think we are arriving at that goal by the year 2015. The summit of Helsinki in 1975 was producing an engagement of destining 0.7 of the internal product of every nation for development. And many of the nations never arrived to that. So I think that we need more effort in the international communities to do so. Another negative aspect is the prices of oil and especially the food prices have made impossible to reduce poverty. On the contrary, it has increased by nearly 100 million poor people in the last, I would say, 3 months. So it's necessary to have a very concrete commitment to overcome this.
From your own personal experience, what's the best way in a local situation, what is the best way for money from the outside to be spent? What kind of projects do you think help the development of a poorer country more than others?
I would say especially those destined to educate the people. Not only, I would say, in the formal way of schools that is necessary, but also educating the parents, educating the people to live in a better and more healthy way. And this is, in many nations, a great task that has not been addressed correctly by many governments. Also, health, because the only capital of the poor is health, and unfortunately, the poor have not access to health programs. And I believe that the world has to think more about it. I was listening to some speeches in the UN recently, and they were talking about the epidemic of AIDS, but this is not the main problem, even being a serious problem is not the main one. Malaria and malnutrition are worst, and the problem is that many people do not think in this because they don't have it in their own environments. To look to the underdeveloped world is necessary to be compassionate and to be solidarious.
What is the role of the church in development?
Since 1967, when Paul VI was sending us the letter Populorum Progressio, he said to us that development is the new name for peace. And the church has to continue educating the people in that. development is not a luxury reserved for some nations. Development should be the general program for all the nations in order to live in peace.
And my thanks there to Cardinal Oscar Rodriguez Maradiaga, president of the Caritas Internationalis Global Aid and Development Confederation. Joyful noise unto the Lord. That's exactly what a group of English musicians and singers have been doing in Rome this week, performing a series of reflections in words and music in two churches located at one of the Eternal City's busiest tourist sites, the Pantheon, also known as the Church of St. Mary of the Martyrs, and the nearby Basilica of Santa Maria Sopra Minerva. English orchestra and choir is made up of both professional musicians and others from all walks of life looking for a way to share the joys of their Christian faith through their performances. With a huge repertoire ranging from classical to jazz, gospel and folk songs from countries around the world, the group received standing ovations for their performances throughout the day from thousands of pilgrims, music lovers and just ordinary tourists who happened to be visiting and were able to stop for a moment of musical and maybe spiritual reflection. Halfway through their Rome tour, I caught up with the man who founded the New English Orchestra over 30 years ago and who is still the conductor, pianist and driving force behind this ecumenical group.
My name's Nigel Swinford, and I'm the conductor and the founder of the New English Orchestra. That's an orchestra that's dedicated to playing spiritual music, not exclusively religious music, sometimes the classics and folk music, but it looks at the repertoire and the culture from a Christian standpoint.
Tell us a bit about the people who come to play or sing in this orchestra and choir. It's a very eclectic group, isn't it?
It's a very eclectic group, yes, and you have people like Christopher Poffley, the cellist, who plays with John Elliott Gardner and all the top specialist Baroque groups, tours the world with them, and young violinists like Hannah Smith, who's a working professional and is making her way very successfully in England in that way. On the other hand, the singers are populated by medical people, people who are in the area of defence, people who are in town planning, people who teach for a living. All sorts of professions are represented, but they have a musical talent and they want to use it, and particularly they want to use it to glorify God.
Is it that really is the driving inspiration behind this orchestra? You've been going for more than 30 years now, haven't you? As you say, people wanting to use their talents in a very special way.
Yes, that's a difficult question to answer, really. At the most basic level, it's to glorify God, to give him thanks for his creation, to give him thanks for great music, to give him thanks for his son, and for the gospel. And our great desire, I think, is to express it with integrity, not trying to paper over any cracks, not trying to say that everything's easy if you become a Christian, but recognizing the power of God and the love of God as it's spread abroad in a person's life and in the life of a community. It's to say all those things and to give people, perhaps who've never thought about it before, an eye-opener into what it's like to be a Christian.
You're a very mixed group, not only in the different professions and backgrounds represented, but also ecumenically. You come from a variety of churches, don't you?
We do. I never actually ask anybody of what persuasion they are when they come in. I don't think they'd cope very long here if they weren't believing in Jesus. They wouldn't like the repertoire, for starters. But I don't actually inquire whether they're Protestant or Catholic or what variety of either they might be. But we are a genuinely ecumenical group. We're quite a large group. There are scores of people on the instrumental list and many people on the singers list. And we don't often operate all together. We operate in smaller groups. And you never know when you get a group where the weighting is, whether it's more towards one persuasion or to another. But our joy really is to say the Lord knows all who are his, and that those who reach out in faith to Christ are in one body.
You're playing here in Rome for the second consecutive year. You're playing in the Pantheon this year and Santa Maria Sopra Minerva, two perhaps of Rome's most significant basilicas. What's it like as an experience for you to play in a place like that?
That was very fascinating. Of course, we had to handle the acoustic of the Pantheon. That was very, very unpredictable. I resisted the idea of going there for quite a while. I thought it was musical suicide. But actually, we've had a lovely time, and we've learned a great deal about how to perform in it. We've learned where to stand to get the best effect. And the joy, of course, is that the audience is there already. There's often 1,000 people at the very least in the Pantheon. All you have to do is to start playing and singing, and there is your audience. So it was very exciting for us, actually.
You don't call your performances concerts, you call them recreatio. What do you mean exactly? What do you understand by this?
Well, a recreatio in our minds is a kind of service. One of the clergy at the Pantheon actually called it a paraliturgy. At root, it's simply a sequence of music and readings from the Bible. There are no introductions. It just runs through like a service. But also it commends itself. It's a sort of concert as well, because even if you're not a believer, you can sit there in the audience. You can be refreshed. You can enjoy it. You don't have to stand up or sit down. You don't even have to contribute money in the collection. But you can just hear the word of God and decide what to do with it.
And my thanks there to pianist, composer and conductor Nigel Swinford, the founder of the New English Orchestra that's been performing in Rome this week. You're listening to Vatican Radio, Laudato Jesus Christus.